Welcome to our online event, Mastery 30 Years On, Lessons Learned? This event is hosted by the LSE European Institute as part of the LSE European Institute's 30th anniversary celebrations. I am Professor Yaprak Gürsoy, and I'm the Chair of Contemporary Turkish Studies at the LSE European Institute. I'm very pleased to be chairing this event today and pleased to welcome our speakers. Before I introduce our distinguished speakers to you, I have a few housekeeping announcements. First, for those Twitter users in the audience, the hashtag for today's event is LSEEI30. So please, if you want to tweet about this event, do so with using the hashtag LSEEI30. This event is being recorded. And if we don't have any technical difficulties, it will be made available as a podcast later on. So if you feel like you missed something, you will be able to listen to the event again. Our event will consist of presentations from our speakers, followed by some further questions and a Q&A with the audience. When we come to the Q&A portion of our event, we will prompt you and we will ask you to use the Q&A feature at the bottom of your screen. You can also pose your questions during the speakers when they're speaking, and we can collect the questions and ask them later on. I will be reading out the questions, and I will pose as many as possible to our speakers. When you ask questions, please do also let us know your name and affiliation. Now to introduce our speakers in order of speaking, our first speaker will be Professor Piers Ludlow. Professor Ludlow is the head of the LSE Department of International History. He was previously a British Academy postdoctoral fellow at Balliol College at Oxford. Then he joined LSE in 1998, so he has been with the LSE for a long time. Professor Ludlow's main research interests lie in the history of Western Europe since 1945, and in particular, the historical roots of the integration process in the EU and the development of the European Union. Our second speaker will be Kevin Featherstone, who is the Eleftherios Venizelos Professor in Contemporary Greek Studies and Professor in European Politics in the European Institute at LSE. He's also the director of the Hellenic Observatory at the European Institute. In 2013, he was made Commander Order of the Phoenix by the President of the Hellenic Republic, and this year he was bestowed the award of Grand Commander Order of the Phoenix of the Hellenic Republic. And our final speaker will be Professor Dame Helen Wallace, who is a political scientist and whose research has focused on the politics of European integration. She has held appointments at LSE, at the European University Institute, Florence Sussex European Institute, the Royal Institute of International Affairs, and the College of Europe. She was the director of the ESRC One Europe or Several program, and she became a fellow of the British Academy in 2000. She was the chair of the Political Studies section and then as Foreign Secretary between 2011 to 2015. Now I'm delighted to hand over to Piers and to begin his presentation.
Thank you very much for inviting me. It's a great honor to be taking part in this 30th anniversary celebration for the European Institute. But in a way, I want to start off with a complaint, namely that this is too early to allow a historian fully to contribute to this discussion, because political historians tend to be reliant on archives opening, and the archival opening for the period that we're discussing today is just about happening, but not quite there. So this is a kind of slightly tantalizing event. If this had been the 35th anniversary of the European Institute, I'd have much more to say, but the 30th is, I hope I do have some things to say, but I'm sort of conscious that if you could only have waited a little bit longer, I would have been able to say so much more. So I don't think you're going to get great archival scoops from me, but I will nevertheless try to say a few things that are of interest. I suppose I have three main points to make. The first is that I think looking as a historian at the Maastricht Treaty, I'm very conscious of the way in which this is, at the treaty and at the treaty's aftermath, I'm very conscious of the way in which this is in many ways the apogee of what one might call the treaty making or the treaty reforming period of European integration history. The European community was an institution created by treaty, of course, but for its first 20 years of operation, it managed to change considerably, evolve considerably, without changing its treaties. You then go embark on a period from 1986, which I suppose runs the way all the way up to the Lisbon Treaty of 2008, so a 20-year window during which treaty reform became the norm, became something that was part of normal life. And now we're back, perhaps, in a phase where treaty making has become all but impossible. But I think Maastricht, although it comes early on in that 20-year window, is quite significant because you see both the desire to improve the institutions, to change the entity by reforming the treaty and going through the intergovernmental conference procedure, etc. But you also begin to see the downside of it. The Single European Act in 1986 had been a treaty that at the time didn't seem perhaps quite as special as it subsequently became seen as, but nevertheless was regarded as a real success. Maastricht, by contrast, was greeted with relief, with pleasure at the time, and I think with hindsight you can point to many important features of it. But its aftermath, the Danish referendum, no, the very narrow petit oui that the French gave it, the huge trials and tribulations that John Major's government went through in this country to get it through, in a sense foreshadow the subsequent difficulties of treaty reform that we've now grown familiar with Nice, with the Nice Treaty, with the Constitutional Treaty, and so on and so forth. So I think in some ways this represents the kind of apogee of the treaty making moment. It was a big, bold treaty, although it didn't go as far as many wanted. And in a sense, it demonstrated both the possibilities of the treaty making process, but also their limitations. So that would be my first point. The second point I think I'd make is that as I was sort of preparing for this talk and revisiting some of the literature on the various national starting positions as you go into the negotiations, I am struck by how narrow the sort of zone of agreement, the landing zone, you might put it, was. It is, I think, tempting with historical hindsight to look back at the Maastricht Treaty and play a game of if only they'd done that, or if only that had been different and we could have altered that, etc. And of course, that's in some ways a legitimate activity. But I am very conscious, reading the process of so what we know about the negotiations, that it would have been difficult to arrive at anything radically different. In particular, the idea that you often see touted about that this is a kind of a half treaty. It didn't deliver the political side to accompany the economic aspect of EMU. Well, yes, I think that's a criticism that could be made, but there was no real possibility of that happening at the time. I think we can argue about whether opportunities were missed further on. We can perhaps argue about the kind of fundamental trajectory of the integration process from going much further back. But in a sense, Europe was on a road which led to a fairly narrowly defined view of EMU well before the Maastricht Treaty. And what happened in those months and years leading up to the treaty signature, in a sense, only confirmed a direction of travel that was already pretty well set, pretty well established. We could have arrived at a different place and in a different fashion, but I think that would have been require a very substantial rewriting of history. It's quite a big reach. So I think the easy criticisms that one can perhaps make, while easy, are perhaps a little bit misleading. And third point, I think I'll end on a sort of slightly parochial Britain and Europe point. I do also look back at this occasion as somebody who is now committed to writing a book on Britain's 46 years as a community union member and sort of assessing this in the round. I do look back at it as a sort of with a sort of hint of nostalgia as a sort of unlikely high point of British Europeanism. Now, it's a funny kind of high point because, of course, the British were in many ways the odd ones out even at Maastricht, and the achievements of which Major did or didn't say that it was game, set and matched Britain were largely consisted of opt-outs and things of that nature. So decisions not to participate rather than to participate. But I do think the manner in which Britain negotiated, the manner in which Britain engaged with the process, the way in which they discussed within government their engagement with their partners and with the whole diplomatic game within the European community does nevertheless come across as something that, from the benefit of those of us looking back from Brexit Britain of 2021, strikes me as really very significant. This was the brief period when the new, relatively newly installed Major government really wanted to engage positively, really sought to negotiate in a constructive fashion, sought to build alliances with Kohl's Germany, sought to really kind of plug Britain in. Yes, the British couldn't accept everything that others wanted to do and therefore did play a negative game to some extent. But I do also think this is a moment where the British were prepared to see the benefits of the European integration process, negotiate in sort of really good faith and in a fairly communautaire fashion, up to a point, and to really feel that this was part of a process that might, well, that they were part of a process that would lead on to other different and greater things in the future. And there is hence a kind of sense of nostalgia as I revisit the British files from this period and contrast that with the situation that we now find ourselves in. But that's probably my 3 points. So I'm conscious of the time, so I will stop there.
Thank you very much for that first talk, a very concise one. Now over to Professor Kevin Featherstone.
Thank you very much indeed. And it's a great pleasure to be with both Piers and Helen, for whom I have the highest respect. I think a colleague, Areti, is going to share a screen, and I want to just talk to a couple of two or three slides. Great. So I want to try to look at the innovations of the Maastricht Treaty and also perhaps the lessons for us subsequently, which still are relevant to today. So if we could move to the first slide, the next slide. So as Piers has said, it's the biggest step forward for European integration since the 1950s. That's why we're talking about it. That's the significance. And it's important in terms of the depth of integration, the creation of the single European currency, most notably, but also the breadth of integration as well, the common foreign security policy, the justice and home affairs pillars. And the institutional innovations, the attempt to change the relationship between the Council of Ministers and the European Parliament, new legislative procedures, new rights for the European Parliament. And it also represented, as Piers has said in other terms, the same point. It's the last hurrah of a wartime generation, leaders who had themselves personal, meaningful experience of wartime Europe. Helmut Kohl's brother had died in the Second World War. François Mitterrand had direct experience of wartime conflicts, etc. And that motivated them. Indeed, the narrative of I may be the last European leader you can do business with, etc., because of that shared wartime experience and what European integration meant for that generation. So nothing comparable since that point. If we could go to the next slide, please. But I want to focus more on the one domain of the single European currency, economic and monetary union. And I'm going to make these four points. Firstly, that's the adoption of the single currency commitment in the treaty made the integration process far more ideological than before. The single currency was based largely on Odo-liberal principles from Germany. Indeed, it was a very substantial victory for an Odo-liberal paradigm for economic integration. A victory to some extent for neoliberalism as well, the elevating of the principles of sound money, monetary stability above everything else. And it locked, therefore, the participating member states into a politics of deflation. It assumed financial markets would be able to discipline national governments who stepped out of line, didn't follow the rules. Ignoring other political economy traditions in Europe, which had been built up over many decades, Keynesianism, republicanism in France, et cetera, et cetera. But it's an incomplete victory for ordoliberalism and neoliberalism, because in the end, despite some attempts, the final treaty said nothing about supply side economics, wage flexibility, the flexibility of labor markets. It also, as Piers has alluded to, rejected notions of economic governance as well, ideas put forward by Pierre Bérégovoy in the late 1980s, but also ideas put forward in 1970 by Pierre Werner, the Werner Report, from which we get the title Economic and Monetary Union. It ignored the E of the EMU and created a skewed structure as a result. The second point is that it also created political assumptions which proved to be very shallow, misconceived, and actually faulty. The design of economic and monetary union borrowed from Germany the idea of central bank independence. And of course, we should recognize that in historical context, this was a major change for countries such as France, but also others as well. It took from the German model central bank independence without also at the same time recognizing that in the context of Germany, the Bundesbank was located in a fully developed political system, a fully developed political system, which the European Union itself had not yet and still not created. So it then created the risks of legitimation in a limited, skewed political regime. It's also bequeathed, because of the ordoliberalism, a set of rules which provided a very weak capacity for crisis management. The proposition that there could be no bailouts, but at the same time, no country could be expelled from the European euro system. And what became a light monitoring of the rules, the extent to which member states were actually following the rules. So it created a skewed crisis management structure, an incapacity to act once a crisis would occur. And it also failed to address what surely was the likelihood of the need for burden sharing, a theme which European integration had not hitherto tackled and which in subsequent years has challenged the European Union in a kind of existential crisis. That is, it did not foresee the need for some future crisis of fiscal transfers. It believed in the ordoliberal proposition that member governments should follow the rules of their own self-discipline, monetary stability, sound money, etc. And that if they failed to do so, the financial markets would punish them. My third point is that it's also a treaty which represents, yes, the biggest step forward since the 1950s, but it also divided Europe between ins and outs countries such as the UK, Denmark and Ireland, which had various kinds of opt-outs. But it also, as Piers has alluded to, stimulated a new phenomenon, a new British export of Euroscepticism, a sense that Maastricht was going too far. Can I just mention at this point that at the time of the Maastricht negotiations, Piers has very accurately talked about a narrow landing zone. Let me just add one thing to that. When it came to the idea of a single currency and the regime that was necessary, in many ways, the UK, the John Major government, in terms of economic philosophy, was far more convergent to the Germans and the Dutch position than was France. But the distinctive elements for the British, the element that prevented the British joining in, was, of course, national sovereignty and the sensitivity about national sovereignty. So in that sense, it was a harbinger, a foreshadowing of conflict about Europe going too far and creating a Euroscepticism along the same path, but also a sense of an incomplete design of the European Union as a system. Fourth point, if we are to explain, as political scientists rather than historians, if we are to explain why there was the Economic and Monetary Union agreement, why the single currency was agreed, then I think it's teaching us that the historical explanation has got to go beyond economics. It's beyond simple calculations of rational interest. A rational choice model, I think, would be far too limiting. Some watching will be aware of the Andrew Muravchik interpretation in his book of 1998, in which he emphasized that the bargain of the single currency came about essentially as a result of a conflation, a convergence of economic interests. I think I would go beyond that, and with my co-author Kenneth Dyson for the book that we wrote about the Maastricht Treaty, emphasize that other issues of geopolitics were very relevant. I've already mentioned the British sensitivity about sovereignty, but there's also the question of leadership as well. Would any German chancellor have behaved like Helmut Kohl? Would any French presidents like François Mitterrand, perhaps more particularly any commission presidents like Jacques Delors? So to reduce in the Muravchik model that we can explain history on the basis of a convergence of economic interests, I think misses some very important contextual points of the historical process. Final slide, if I may, we can go to the next slide. Yes, so what have we learned? I think four main points. Firstly, that Maastricht had narrowed the economic ideology of the European Union, of the integration process. This created risks, and it also actually proved unsustainable. The assumption that financial markets would punish governments that stepped out of line didn't work for Greece. Financial markets assumed the Eurozone was a club, would behave collectively and would show solidarity. So if we look at the bond spreads between Germany and Greece for much of the Eurozone's early history, there was a minimal difference in those bond spreads. But also, I think we can argue that the rules established by the Maastricht Treaty actually proved to be pro-cyclical. and have worsened the ups and the downs of the European economy for those member states within the euro system. And of course, now with COVID, there's a very real debate as to whether we should simply ditch those fiscal rules anyway. So what seem to be immutable rules established by some ordo-liberal philosophy for the Maastricht Treaty have proved to be unsustainable, and with a change of an ideational climate, a sense that these rules were no longer fitting current needs anyway. A second point is that the unsustainability of the ordo-liberal assumptions on self-discipline ignited conflicts over burden sharing, whether there needed to be solidarity to save the system. So the rules on no bailouts were put aside precisely to save the euro system. But the burden sharing theme obviously became much more inflamed with the migrant crisis later. So the notion that European integration could be built on the self-discipline of member states, I think simply proved to be inadequate and erroneous. But once the decision, third point, once the decision was taken, in effect to let every member state enter, the idea that the Eurozone could be governed separately from considerations of the domestic institutional capacity of member states simply proved unrealistic. We had new moral hazard concerns as the rules were circumvented. The Eurozone proved susceptible to different capacities of states to reform, different institutional qualities of government at home. And so we needed bailouts and conditionality to save a system and to bring the European Union to a position it had never had before of having to develop a new capacity to manage its heterogeneity. Final point. Maastricht was, of course, a major economic leap forward. It showed that the issues surrounding the design of the political system, the political structure, the governance of the European Union could not be ignored. A quick dash for deep integration on the basis of a technocratic model supervised by central bankers simply proved to be ill-conceived from the very beginning. And in that sense, Maastricht has proved to be an ambition, but it remains unfinished business in terms of the decision, in terms of the trying to design a system of governance for the European Union, which is both effective and legitimate. So I will leave it there. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Professor Featherstone. And now we are turning to Professor Wallace.
Prak, thank you very much. And thank you to colleagues in the European Institute, where I spent some happy years, for the opportunity to take part in this discussion. I have no archives here, neither do you yet. I have a faulty memory, and you know perfectly well that memory can be very deceptive, so apologies in advance for what I'm misremembering. And an acknowledgement to Kevin, since Kevin's done so much work on EMU and the Maastricht Treaty. I'm aiming off the EMU subject for the moment, not because it's not important, but because I was perfectly aware that Kevin was going to talk about it. I've written four headings down about Maastricht with hindsight. First, let the people speak. Second, embedding exceptionalism. Third, post-war settlement. And fourth, enlargement in prospect. And let me just say a word about each of those. First, let the people speak. Before Maastricht, referenda had mainly been on the issues relating to EU membership, particularly in candidate countries. And it was a little bit of a surprise in a way when Denmark and Ireland both had what turned out to be successful referenda on the Single European Act in 1986. By the time of Maastricht, the political mood had changed. And I guess that's partly because, and then Kevin has illustrated this very well, the stakes involved in the treaty reform process seemed much more obviously salient than this sort of regulatory nerdish anorak stuff as a Single European Act, which is genuinely important but not exciting. Partly because talk about the democratic deficit had become more common. And partly because there was a question hanging in the air, Kevin didn't say this, about the acceptability or not of the euro to German domestic opinion, as opposed to German government. So was there going to be a referendum in Germany? Referenda were held in Denmark, France, Ireland, and in anticipation, Italy. I guess everybody knows that Denmark was the one that produced a negative result and highlighted points that we've become much more familiar with about the tension between elites and society, between parliamentary democracy and plebiscitary democracy, and some of the curiosity of political culture in Denmark, Pastor Grundtvig, and all that. And what's also interesting is that Denmark was the first member state to be asked to have second thoughts and have another go in order to get a positive result, which it did, quite a shift in opinion after the Edinburgh Declaration, which I'll come back to in a moment. But referenda were not held in some countries where the question hung in the air. So there wasn't one in Germany, and there wasn't one in the United Kingdom, although some people had advocated that there should be. And in subsequent history, referenda became more common on treaty reform processes. So Maastricht had kind of opened the Pandora's box, if you like. Ireland twice producing a negative referendum and being asked, please vote again, Irish. And in the European Constitution, and then let's just clarify a difference here. Ireland voted no to Nice and Lisbon. The moment France voted no to the European Constitutional Treaty, followed by the Netherlands, well, that's that then. If countries of that importance vote no, we can't ask them to vote again. So this is a different version of the ins and outs stories. Some can be asked again and some can't. And indeed, on the European Constitution, there were four referenda were held, two positive, two negative, and another six, which didn't take place, but which might have taken place. So the referendum game became more common. Second point, embedding exceptionalism. The Maastricht Treaty, in effect, contained quite a lot of exceptionalism in the treaty. The UK was given scope for being different. It embedded, and I think this is really important, and maybe Piers and I should have a conversation about this separately at some point. It embedded the notion and plausibility of opt-outs as the way for the UK to solve its differences and disagreements with other parts of the European Union. And Britain became an exceptionalist country, the budget, Schengen, all these other things that we know about. And they're part of the longer story of the UK-EU relationship. So I don't see, as I think Piers did, Maastricht as a high point of British engagement. I find it as an example of a different trajectory for the UK. Denmark was granted opt-outs in Edinburgh, EMU, European Citizen, JHA, and so forth. Fine, because it's only Denmark, isn't it? Doesn't matter so much. Set the pattern imitated by Ireland. And I just say a footnote here, we're talking about Maastricht, not Lisbon. Might have been better for the UK if we'd had a referendum on the Lisbon Treaty rather than leaving it for a referendum on membership, but the cards didn't fall like that. Third, post-war settlement. Post-war settlement, which war? Why did the Maastricht Treaty take place? It took place because the Cold War had come to an end with the breaching of the Berlin Wall and the collapse of the Soviet Empire. But the conversation in and around Maastricht was actually about the Second World War and not about the Cold War. There is a story, and maybe Piers will find it in the archives, that François Mitterrand came to one of those European Council meetings brandishing a letter that he alleged had been sent by Adenauer, given by Adenauer to General de Gaulle, saying, even if Germany becomes a larger country, we, the Germans, will not ask for a more weighty representation in the institutional setup. And there was quite an argument about how the treaty should or shouldn't be adapted to take account of German unification. And I think the German unification story is an important part of the background. The Germans were the French were very nervous of the Germans. I remember having a conversation with Andreas van Eyck, the Dutch Prime Minister, who had been Dutch Prime Minister at the time, saying, what were the Dutch saying about this? He said, it was all right, we were saying it in Dutch, but nobody understood what we were saying. So we could say nasty things about the and frightened things about the Germans, but the rest of the world wouldn't hear us. So Maastricht was part of the post-war settlement, a reconfirmation of the project, the integration project, much more about Western Europe than about drawing in the Central and Eastern Europe. And let me also say that, I mean, Piers will have the opportunity to explore this in more detail as documents become available. I think read it at the UK, in spite of, especially after Maastricht had led, the Maastricht process had led to the casualty of a British Prime Minister. Second time European negotiations have dealt, seen off a woman Prime Minister. I don't see the UK as having got its fingerprints really over the content of the Maastricht Treaty, in contrast to the Single European Act, which was covered with British fingerprints. Fourth point, enlargement in prospect. The Maastricht Treaty really didn't get a grip on enlargement. And it's interesting because actually more or less simultaneously, the EFTA countries one after another were pursuing a goal of full membership of the European Union and not regarding the European Economic Area as sufficient. But it didn't kind of grip the Maastricht Treaty, and it wasn't until later, the Nice Treaty and so on, that it became clear that the European Economic Area wouldn't suffice and that other things would need to be done for the remaining West European neighbours. And at the time of Maastricht, the people who were talking about the Central and East European countries were talking very much the language of technical assistance to the countries of Central and Eastern Europe and not accession support. That came later, didn't really kick in till 1995 onwards. So the Maastricht Treaty, for me, lacks a couple of elements. One, the institutional changes to accommodate a larger membership. And secondly, not picking up Jacques Delors' call for a single European area, which would have forms of association that would cure the keenness for enlargement from other European countries. So that's my version of what I know, remember from the history. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I think that these presentations provide quite a large array of topics that we can cover in the Q&A portion of this event. And I see already a couple of questions, but what I want to do first is to give Piers the opportunity to respond to the two presentations, because in a way, they were responding to him implicitly or explicitly. So it is only fair for him to, you know, respond to them. In particular, it seemed to me that Kevin's and Helen's presentations were more pessimistic looking back at the Maastricht Treaty. So it seemed a bit like, you know, there were negative lessons to be learned. Whereas you were more optimistic and you even used the word nostalgia. So you were looking back with, you know, a more, let's say, positive stance. So do you agree with the things that have been said, or do you still think that overall Maastricht Treaty should be seen as something more positive, especially in terms of UK's relations with the EU back then?
I think I do have a more positive reading. I think this may be perhaps that I'm an incurable optimist, even when looking backwards at history rather than looking forwards. But I think it is more serious than that. I think on the sort of to take some of Kevin's points, first of all, so I do think in some ways, some of what, so I think a lot of the criticisms that Kevin is putting forward are logical and very well grounded, given what we know has happened since. I suppose my starting point, however, was looking at what was going to be possible in the late 1980s, early 1990s, as Europe contemplated further treaty reform. And it does strike me that in some ways, the kind of things that Kevin is saying ought to have been there in an ideal world were only really possible in an ideal world and weren't at all realistic in the Europe of 1989, 1991. So for instance, take burden sharing. There was no way that countries of Europe as they were constituted and the governments of Europe as they were constituted in 1991 were going to agree on a treaty about monetary union which involved large amounts of burden sharing. We might wish that they had done so. Maybe had they been able to do so in some Panglossian universe, history would have been very different. But I do think it's sort of important to remember that sort of in a sense, the road towards a, if you want to call it low budget, low cost version of EMU was already pretty set long before Maastricht. There was no going back to the McDougall report of the 1970s with its large, of its discussion of large scale fiscal transfers. That just wasn't going to happen. And therefore the real choice that Europe faced in 1989-1991, as it contemplated a move towards economic and monetary union, was a move towards the economic and monetary union, the sort of half finished, imperfect, low cost, variant that was created, or a move back towards full monetary independence and shifting exchange rates. That was the choice that Europe faced. And I do think that looking at this as a historian, I do find myself thinking, okay, yes, it could have been better. And I think in the finer details, one could doubtless find points that could have been adjusted. But I don't think it's, in a sense, realistic to say we could have got massively more than we did. And in a sense, therefore, the alternative to what we did or what Europe did at that point was actually to say, oh, hang the whole European monetary experience, let's go back to the 1970s and floating exchange rates. That was essentially the choice that was faced, and therefore I can't look at it quite in the negative fashion that Kevin did. And similarly, in a way, with some of the points that Helen was making about British membership, I agree that it embeds British exceptionalism in a sense. It's not totally new because the British had already kind of had a, in effect, opt out on the European monetary system and various other things, although it wasn't given that name. But I agree that Maastricht sets a pattern which would subsequently recur, etc. I suppose what I'm commenting on more is the way in which the major government approached the negotiations. I agree that the Single European Act, in a sense, is a precedent of British engagement. But I suppose the contrast that I'm drawing with the major government is actually not with mid-term Thatcher of 85, 86, but late Thatcher, which of 88, 89, 90, which was all about no, no, no. And if the British had continued along those lines, there would have been, well, there would have been a major bust up and possibly no treaty at all. And I suppose the contrast I'm drawing, therefore, is the way in which the major government responded to that negativity and tried to adopt a much more constructive, positive approach, even if it meant accepting, as it did in the area of social policy and it did in the area of EMU, that the only way in which Britain could be constructive was to say, OK, you go that direction and we won't. But that was a much more positive, if you want, form of sceptical engagement than the very sort of destructive engagement that Mrs. Thatcher had sought to pursue in her latter years in power. So that's, I suppose, the positivity. I agree it's a glass half empty sort of positive, so I'm certainly not claiming that it was full-throated pro-Europeanism, and I would accept Helen's point about the British having earlier had periods of constructive engagement, notably around the Single Market Project and the Single European Act in the mid-1980s. So it's not totally new. But I do think there is an element of nostalgia about that. And I think, again, just to end on the parochial British point, it is also worth remembering that these years were a brief moment of opportunity where all of the major parties in Britain were actually pro-European. That had not been the case, although Labour was on the road to changing its position with the Single European Act. And it wouldn't be the case by the time you get to the later the treaties of the late 1990s. Early 2000s, by which time the Conservatives had moved into a pretty Eurosceptic position. But actually the 1993 general election was fought on much, much more pro-European positions than virtually any other election has been. And again, from the context of 2021, that is perhaps something that deserves to be underlined.
To follow up on that, we actually have a question about Euroscepticism in the UK, and this is what I was wondering about as well. So I would pose the question to the panel in the form of, do you think that the Maastricht Treaty sowed the seeds of Brexit? But John Peat formulated a more detailed question. So he's asking if you think the lengthy nightmare of ratifying Maastricht through the period 1992 to 1994, and particularly the role of Tory backbenchers, whom John Major termed bastards, was the foundation of today's Tory Euroscepticism. And hence that, without Maastricht, we might never had Brexit. So in the sense that we have this opportunity of pro-European political parties in the UK, but with Maastricht, that was lost in a couple of years' time. And so from there on, it was just downhill. What do you think about that? Who wants to answer the question first?
Can I come in on that? Yes, I think Maastricht is the antecedent to Brexit in within the Conservative Party politics, because it's at that point when we have divisions amongst the former Thatcherites as to what a Thatcherite position should be in terms of European integration and economic integration in particular. But I agree with what I think Helen was suggesting, and that is that had there been a referendum in the UK at the time of the Maastricht Treaty, then I think there's all of the evidence to say that it would have been won. That is that Euroscepticism was still at that stage a minority sport between consenting adults, to mix the metaphors. But within Conservative Party politics, yes, it is the start of a Eurosceptic challenge. It's the bridge between a relatively small number of rebellious Conservative backbenchers and a tabloid press, a Conservative supporting press. It's the start of that kind of bridge of Euroscepticism between backbenchers and the media. Could I take the opportunity of just responding to a point that Piers made?
Yes.
Entirely agree that we should look and judge these things with hindsight. But I think I'm not. I think I'm referring to criticisms made at the time. Piers makes the perfectly legitimate point that it was a half finished projects at low cost. Half finished, yes, low cost, no. And at the time, I think it was recognized that it was rather risky. A number of economists, Willem Buiten, who joined the European Institute during our 30 years, made a point about the rules of the Eurozone being unworkable. And that was pretty soon after the Maastricht Treaty was agreed, before even it was ratified. So half finished or half baked, whatever one wants to describe it as. I think my point was, at the time, it was foreseeable that a quick dash to a kind of technocratic integration with the Eurozone came with severe risks. And narrowing it down on the basis of penalties and of self-discipline by national governments, with no surrounding political system to legitimate it, was just setting things up for a crisis, a political crisis, which then we saw within the Eurozone debt crisis much later. So was it a good idea to have a quick dash with a half-baked idea, with a half-baked project? I think what I'm emphasizing is that the political analysis at the time was actually remarkably shallow. And that's what we were also writing at the time, that it was taking things from the German model in a very particularistic fashion without sensitivity to the nature of the wider political system and the need for legitimation. In that sense, I think it's the last hurrah, as Delors himself recognized a couple of years later, it's the last hurrah of a kind of elite knows best, quick dash, and assumptions of public opinion being permissive, and we'll win them round later. It's the last hurrah of a technocratic elitism, which I suppose one could argue was a kind of Jean Monnet philosophy from the 50s, and was sustained right to that particular point. After Maastricht, Delors, others were emphasizing the need to bring the people on board. Why? Because, as Helen was saying, the referenda experience was not going quite according to plan. Thanks.
Well, both Helen and Piers want to respond. Piers promised that he's going to be quick.
just simply saying, sort of, Kevin picked up on the phrase low cost. I didn't mean low political cost. I was simply referring to sort of low levels of budgetary transfer. So in other words, not the 5 to 10% or whatever the McDougall had been envisaging, but instead much lower levels of centralised budget. So that was all I meant.
Okay. Thank you very much, Helen.
I want to come back to John Pete's question about Euroscepticism. I mean, for me, the roots are older, a good deal older than the Maastricht experience, and more diverse. The narratives of successive British governments, even the ones that have been more sympathetic to the European project, have been very much a we and them vocabulary. British governments have never owned up to their successes, such as the Single European Act process in 1992, and have never cultivated opinion. We went straight from accession to renegotiation and a very painful referendum campaign. And yes, that referendum was won, but it left us and them and a toxicity about anything to do with community finances. Remember that in the 1980s, a Labour Party had fought an election on leave the European Union. I think it's quite wrong to say that either the Labour Party or the Conservative Party were pro-European parties at any point. There were periods when the pro-Europeans were in the ascendance in those parties, and there were periods when the anti-Europeans were in the ascendance, and that's left painful divisions in both countries. And it's interesting to see now how pro-European John Major is and how critical he's been of the Johnson government. But it wasn't all quite so clear when he was banging on for the Ioannina Declaration or when he vetoed the appointment of Jean-Luc Dehaene as president of the European Commission, who had done a damn sight better job than Jacques Santer. So I think there's an older story there. And Maastricht is just one important step in that journey, with the unfortunate consequences that we know about.
Thank you very much for that. Now I have a question from Professor Walter Schalke. She is one of our European Institute professors. She is asking in particular to Kevin, but anyone can respond to the question. So she's saying, I'm always a bit skeptical about the ordoliberal foundations of the euro area. If the euro is an ordoliberal creation, did the French, Italian and other governments sign the Maastricht Treaty in bad faith? Is it not more plausible to think that every country had reasons to adopt a common currency and that these reasons were complementary, such as low inflation is compatible with low interest rates, and taking away powers from the Bundesbank also means taking away Italy's ability to devalue?
Well, thanks, if I may. Valtra makes good points, but I'm afraid I disagree with them on the following basis. That is that what we were talking about is the design, the idea of central bank independence was one which was an anathema to France and even for the Mitterrand administration. The politics of money played out differently in the French case. The political management of the currency was different in the French case. I think also the reliance on the rules and the self-discipline of the various member governments clearly comes from that ordo-liberal philosophy. So why did the rest agree? I think the rest agreed because the existing status quo was itself disadvantageous. Maastricht wasn't happening in a vacuum, but we had the papers from Giuliano Amato in France and Pierre Bergoglio, Amato in Italy and Bergoglio in France, complaining that the existing European monetary system was disadvantageous to those countries. So it wasn't as if they were dealing with something with a clean sheet, as it were. So signing up, it goes back, to Piers's point, it was the only deal in town. Both Balladur and Amato thought that the market advantage for the Deutschmark was so fundamentally established and disadvantageous to France and Italy that a common currency was desirable. But we shouldn't ignore the fact that they, that is France and Italy, ditched many of their own preferences in order to concede the bargain with Germany. And one such, of course, is the idea of economic governance, which had been a strong French notion. And for Italy, it was indeed the absence of sufficient compensatory payments. So I think, it would be difficult to argue that the Maastricht design was reflective of anything else other than ordo-liberalism in the main. The second question, why did the rest agree? I think it's the bargaining. Would other states like low inflation? Yes, of course they would, but also they were adopting a much more Keynesian-like policy frame in that respect. So I think I would stick with the proposition I was making and agree to buy Valtrad a coffee in compensation.
Okay. Piers, would you like to respond to the discussion so far? Both the answer to this question or it could be about the previous discussion as well.
It's okay. So I might have made a point about Euroscepticism, but we're in a sense we moved on. So let's continue moving.
Okay. Helen, do you want to respond? All right. So we actually have another question. So William Malater, and I'm apologizing for mispronouncing names here today. Please bear with me. William is asking, is the pandemic and the subsequent creation of a collective debt mechanism in the EU a chance to learn from Maastricht's lessons? In response to Helen Wallace's points on the limited discussion on accession of Central and Eastern European countries at Maastricht, do you see the European Union enduring another crisis with Poland's political current stance? How could this evolve? So I guess this would be first a question to Helen, and then the others can chip in as well.
I thought we were having history conversations today and not speculations about the future. So I'm not sure what to say about the Polish situation or indeed the Hungarian situation. Here are two member states that are going through versions of political processes that don't fit very well with what we think the prevailing norms and values ought to be of the European collective process. The scenes on the Polish-Belarus border are horrific. I think we're living through a period where nasty politics is all too tempting. And we in the UK aren't in a very good position to make pronouncements about virtuous democratic behaviour. In this sense, but not for any other, I'm quite relieved that the British government doesn't have to take a position on the Polish and Hungarian issues. And I feel great sympathy for Frans Timmermans and others who are trying to navigate through some very choppy waters. That's a cop-out, but there you go.
Does anyone else want to respond to the question? I guess the question had two parts. So the first part was about the pandemic and the subsequent creation of a collective debt mechanism in the EU, whether this was a chance to learn from Maastricht's lessons. Was it in the sense that the pandemic created an opportunity to fill some of the gaps that the Maastricht Treaty left open?
I don't know whether Piers wants to go first or however you wish.
So I wouldn't necessarily just identify it as the pandemic. I would suggest that in a sense the landing zone couldn't have been very different at Maastricht. I do think I would then read the subsequent 30 years as a process of slowly, probably inadequately, gradually plugging some of the gaps. And indeed, in many ways, that was what the Maastricht negotiators expected. Sort of one of the features of this treaty-making phase that I'm talking about is that sort of a lot of the people who, as Kevin reminds us, were critical of what had been agreed or not agreed at Maastricht, in a sense said, okay, we'll continue the conversation. We'll do this in the follow-up negotiations, etc. Now, in fact, those treaties too fell short of many of their objectives, and we've now moved into a phase where actually amending the treaties has become all but impossible. But the way that the EU functions is to go on sort of discussing things, seizing opportunities as they arise. And I'm not necessarily saying that, so I think some of the rhetoric about Hamiltonian moments, etc., that accompanied the recent decisions over the pandemic were massively overstated. But I do think we, in a sense, as commentators, we keep on expecting huge leaps forward, whereas actually I think the process by which the EU evolves is much more incremental, much messier, much more inadequate. But at the same time, there is perhaps a direction of travel which is discernible over time. So I don't think I want to identify the pandemic as the key moment, but I do think there has been a process of trying to make do some of the shortcomings of the Maastricht Treaty over the last 30 years, and the pandemic perhaps fits into that pattern.
Yes, I would agree with that. I think it emphasises changes in the prevailing ideas, the climate of ideas of a particular period. As Piers alluded to before, if we'd had economic and monetary union in the 1970s, it would have had a very different frame, fundamentally much more Keynesian. By 1990-1991, the prevailing orthodoxy had shifted towards a more neoliberal stance and the importance of combating inflation rather than Keynesian pump priming for economic growth. If I had ventured to say that there was a design now of the Eurozone, would we have these rules? No. The prevailing orthodoxy has moved on yet again. And can I just mention, in terms of the rules, that the rules like the 3% and the 60% have no ground in economic theory. They were simply calculated as the average that would allow the greatest number of member states to join at that time. So I think we have to emphasize the changes in prevailing fashions in economics. I know we wouldn't necessarily associate economists with fashion, but dare I say, their ideas become fashionable in this way. Is it a game changer? Rather like the even more than the French Revolution, it's too early to say. But I think it does represent the biggest intellectual challenge to the Maastricht design. And perhaps it emphasizes to us also that we shouldn't run the risk of simply focusing on what's happening within the European Union. But as someone suggested, clearly internationally, the economic orthodoxy is changing. Joe Biden getting trillions and trillions of dollars budget through Congress is symptomatic of that wider shift of economic thinking internationally, of which the European Union is just one part. So in short, the biggest challenge to the orthodoxy of Maastricht and definitely has the potential to be a game changer. Could I just pick up the point about Poland and rule of law, etc.?
Have a question that would relate to that, because we have a couple of questions that all relate to the future. So I will leave them to the end and I will ask them together. So we will finish with some notes or predictions about the future. But just listening to you, I was thinking also about the enlargement process as well. And this was the last point that Helen made. I was also thinking about the spirit of the times, which relates to the discussion so far. And the spirit of the times in the 1990s, it seems to me that there was an overconfidence of the EU's ability. So for that reason, perhaps in economic terms, there was this belief, there was this confidence that things will just, you know, work out smoothly because it was the end of the Cold War and the West had won, the European Union was the model, it was time for integration, so everything would work out. And with the enlargement process as well, maybe there was that optimistic, outlook, this overconfidence that once countries transition to democracy, once they were members of the EU, they would never go back to authoritarianism. We can even see, this type of overconfidence with the case of Cyprus and accession of Cyprus, that once Cyprus would be, accepted to the European Union, then, the solution on the island would be automatically found almost. So I wonder if you think that this, spirit of the times argument makes sense to you. And have there been lessons learned from those times in the sense that there wasn't actually a lot of reason for the EU to be optimistic and then things can actually backslide in many respects in the economy, in politics, in democracy? Are we there yet? Have we learned this lesson? What do you think? And you can answer the question. We'll start with Helen Pierce, and then Kevin, you can also add your comments on Poland.
I'm not sure I buy your story, Jabrak. I mean, part of what happened in the 1990s was a series of wars in Yugoslavia. There was a Council of Ministers, Foreign Ministers meeting in the middle of 1991. which amongst other things was discussing the renewal of the Yugoslav EU arrangement, which is all about baby beef, very important part of the trading process with Yugoslavia. And the Greek foreign minister said, we should stop talking about baby beef, Yugoslavia is about to fall apart. And you could tell that everybody else said, oh, look at that Greek minister, what's he banging on about? And they didn't take any notice, and then they were to find that the Greek minister had understood much better than most of the other foreign ministers just what a tinderbox there was in Yugoslavia. The European Union still hasn't got a policy towards Russia. It's very confused and ambivalent and ambiguous about Russia. So I don't see overconfidence. Yes, people wanting to continue with the project and do more reforms and so on and so forth and ambitions, but also a lot of confusion about what the possible ways forward were. And let me just say here, I agree very much strongly with Pierre's point about actually the strength of change in the European Union experience is incrementalism rather than large leaps forward. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Pierce?
Just on the sort of spirit of the times thing, I perhaps slightly disagree with Helen here in that I do see a bit more optimism in this period, but in a sense I think there are two different types of optimism that coexist in the 1980s and the early 1990s, which I think are significant for understanding that era. But as Helen reminds us, they could coexist also with a feeling of kind of short-term anxiety or imminent crisis or whatever. So it wasn't sort of everything is going to be okay. But I do think that sort of Brussels and community Europe in the late 1980s was in a kind of localized, specifically European high. That's not to say that there weren't problems, that there weren't day-to-day frustrations, and there were plenty, but there was a sense that this was a process that was moving forward very fast, that it was moving forward almost irresistibly, that you could start coming up with big visions and big plans and big sort of aspirations, because forward movement, having proved very difficult earlier, suddenly seemed to be possible. So there was a moment of hubris, there was a moment of European overreach. I think you see this very clearly in some of Delors' rhetoric, but he's not the only person suffering from it. The European Parliament is an echo chamber, but even within some of the national debates, there was this moment. Europe seemed to be seemed to have the future in its grasp. And so I think that is a moment that deserves to be remembered. I think there's also a wider Western moment of hubris, which follows the end of the Cold War. There is this moment some of us are old enough to remember the end of history being proclaimed in the early 1990s. Sort of democracy had won, communism was dead, so we were now heading into a stable world of a peace dividend, etc. Sort of all of this creates slightly bitter laughter now, but at the time, quite a lot of people bought into that. So I think those two twin optimisms are important for explaining this. But I don't think they necessarily precluded some of the short-term crisis awareness that Helen is talking about, nor did they prevent a very severe headache hangover once that optimistic bubble burst. And I think one of the things that happens at Maastricht is it's not the treaty itself so much, nor is it perhaps the longer term deficiencies that Kevin has been talking about that create that hangover, but the referendums, the popular revolt against it does create a real mood of immediate pessimism in the year or so that follows Maastricht. And if you sort of saw if you had a kind of stock price of European optimism, it's reaching historic highs as you get to Maastricht, but then plummets fairly soon afterwards. And so I think there is a change of mood that is important. I would offer, though, one last thought as a historian about this, and that is that I think we, just as looking back, we can now see that that was a period that rather overdid the optimism. I think we sometimes are in danger more recently of rather overdoing the pessimism. And I have a rather I don't quite buy the sort of massive sine curve of mood that seems to accompany the narratives we tell ourselves about European integration. But I'll leave that thought half expressed.
Well, I think I would agree with that. I think I might extend it a little bit further, however. That is that I think you're right, Jaaprekke, at that time there's a sense of the potential of what Europe could do. Recall that in that period we have people like Heather Grabe talking about transformative Europe, that the European Union could, with enlargement, transform the landscape, bring member states in, and help to reform them at home. So I think there is that optimism, and of course, in some respects, that is sustained at different stages subsequently with the 2004 enlargement. How we speak of enlargement is very much tailored to the 2004 experience and the potential of Europe being the solution, Europe transforming previously communist states. So perhaps I would extend the optimism, but I share your point that it's the hubris, as Piers has said, of a leader-led Europe at the time of Maastricht. And that connects subsequently with a narrative about Europe being able to be the solution and transform the landscape with enlargement. On the point about Poland, I think it is the systemic challenge that has been there in the background for some time for the European Union. I can't immediately think of another case in which the European Union vis-a-vis an existing member state has tried to make the cross-sectoral linkages so ambitiously, from questions of rule of law to whether you get the money. I can't think of any kind of parallel to such a divergent bargain between totally different policy areas. But it is existential, and it does come back to the fundamental point about the design of the European system as being incomplete. How can we have a legitimate, effective European system which doesn't protect basic things like human rights?
Okay, so this will be the last round of questions, and so I'll group them together. They're all related to the future of the European Union or the EU-UK relations. I will group them into three, and you can choose to answer whichever one you want, or all of them. So the first two are from Harold Minaro Escalona. So he's asking first, do you think an ex-government of the UK would pursue EU reintegration, or that would make peace with the EU after all the work that took place with that decision, with the Brexit decision? Second question is asking about the future prospects of the EU. What challenges do you think the EU faces ahead in the next 2 years? And are they an authentic threat, or better, an opportunity to reinforce the EU and the integration process? And the third future-related question is from Rosanna Howgrave Graham, and it is similar to the question that was asked on Facebook by Kamran Safdar. So they're asking, if the Maastricht Treaty can be seen as the apogee of treaty making, successive treaties meeting many problems of ratification and being behind the needs of the time, how can the EU successfully resolve the many current problems whilst retaining some measure of public support? Have we seen the end of treaties and the referendums ratifying these treaties? So related to that, do you believe there will be another treaty such as the Maastricht Treaty, and as significant as the Maastricht Treaty? So shall we start with Helen again?
I think the EU has always overdone it on treaty reform and has not always done as much as it could have done to exploit the existing provisions. And the treaties that we have, with the various amendments that have been agreed, allow an awful lot of scope for the EU to do an awful lot of things without getting dramatic about it, not least in a period where it's become harder and harder to avoid referenda on treaty reforms. And it's not only in Britain that there are sceptical publics. These are a challenge in probably all of the member states, and it always, for me, a barometer that it was the Dutch who followed the French by voting no in 2005 to the Constitutional Convention. On the UK, depends what you think is going to happen. We may be in for the kind of government we've got for some considerable future period. The people who are close to it tell me that things are going to get worse before they get better, and may take it get worse for quite a long time. And who knows when we're going to start developing constructive partnership, good neighbourly, which for me are the priority. Let's talk the language of partnership and neighbourliness. I think we're a long way from being able to contemplate the UK stepping onto the front foot and going for let's have a membership again. And in any case, and let's just remember the point about exceptionalism, were the UK to apply for membership again, it would be a version of membership that would not be covered by all the exceptional opt-outs that have been gained. And that's one of the big mistakes that has been made in the Brexit process. Thank you.
Thank you. Who wants to go first? Piers, yes.
Okay, slightly scattergun series of replies. Perhaps start where Helen left off. I share much of Helen's pessimism about the British situation. I think we're in for a bumpy ride for a while longer. Obviously, it's slightly subject to sort of what happens at the governmental level in Britain. But I'm sort of short of having a total change of government. I don't see a radical change, of course. And I also would tend to think that I think the question of membership is, in a sense, off the table. I think the for quite a long time, if not forever. I think if you wanted the sort of most rosy picture you could paint of British EU relations is some future government deciding that, okay, we do actually have to try and devise a way of living next door to one another in a civilized way. We're some way off that. So I'm afraid I am very gloomy about those prospects. I think I also share Helen's view on treaties. I sort of, in a sense, my point, to go back to the very beginning of what I was saying, is I think we can look at the treaty making phase as something of an aberration. That's not to say that it will never happen again, but it does strike me that Europe decided in the mid 1980s that treaty making was the sort of treaty remaking and treaty reform was the way to go. It embarked upon a long process. At first, it seemed to go very well with the Single European Act and to some extent with Maastricht. Thereafter, things got a bit stickier. It's now developed a kind of profound allergy to the process. And I think it's very difficult to imagine large scale treaty changes being made in a similar fashion. But that does not mean that the Union does not adapt. Just as the 30 years prior to 1986, sort of between the Treaty of Rome and the Single European Act, had seen massive changes in the operation, the structure, the shape of the Union without, or with the community as it then was, without treaty change. So we have had important changes without treaty change since then, and we will go on having it. The EU, if it's to survive, has to adapt, and it will continue to adapt, but it probably just will not do so with the kind of Big Bang treaty style of change that Maastricht is the apogee of. And then finally, just on challenges ahead, as I said, I'm an optimist. I don't think I think the rhetoric of existential challenge tends to be rather overdone in a European context. I rather lament the way in which both pro-Europeans and their critics very quickly seem to pronounce this challenge as being a totally existential one, and if the EU fails this, it will collapse. Now, that's not to say the system can never collapse, but I do think we do need to kind of recognise that we're dealing now with a pretty well-established political system. It will have crises, it will have moments, it will have problems that it doesn't deal with well, it will have moments of real crisis, but we don't necessarily have to assume that collapse is the next station at the next station on the line at every time we have a crisis. I think we should need to develop a slightly more mature debate where we don't constantly say that that this is the last chance saloon.
Okay, Kevin?
Thanks. I agree with the points about the UK. I would simply say that in 10 years' time, will the UK have a closer relationship than currently seems likely? I think the answer is yes. That is that the current position is unstable in many respects. I think economically, there are interests which are there, which are not being satisfied at the moment. So some kind of closer relationship, I think, is very likely within, a decade. On the biggest future challenges, I suppose there is some kind of connection with what I was saying previously. And I genuinely think that the biggest challenge for the European Union is how to manage the heterogeneity of its economies, and allied with that, the heterogeneity in terms of the institutional capacity of its member states to deliver common policies. So the European Union has been developing its structural reform service. I think that is represents a challenge which needs a far greater priority and far greater capacity from the European Union, from the Commission, and it doesn't actually need a treaty change. But if we look at problems of implementation, problems of trying to have common policies and consistency, then I think there is a fundamental problem which goes beyond questions of the Eurozone and is much wider across the EU agenda. So I think we've got to the point of deepening integration from Maastricht, in which we've taken a fairly inclusive strategy of more and more member states joining with enlargements. And I think the European Union needs to address the challenge of dealing with very divergent member states with vastly different institutional capacities, with different reform capacities to deliver the common policies which are being championed and declared at the EU level. So I think that is the one of the biggest challenges that's faced. And to repeat, it doesn't need a constitutional moment to address it.
Okay. Thank you very much. And I think that's wrapped up the session quite neatly, looking at the future and lessons learned from the 1990s onward, and how to actually balance deepening and enlargement, and how to create a system where differences can also be taken into account for the future of the European Union. It has been a great pleasure to have the opportunity for both me and I think for all of you in the audience to listen to our speakers today. Thank you very much to our panel for such an excellent discussion, and to all of you in the audience for listening. If you enjoyed this event and if you would like to learn more about the European Institute and our anniversary events, please head to our website. Thank you. Bye-bye.